Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Ann Arbor District Library. My name is Tim Grimes. I'm the manager of the Community Relations and Marketing Department here at the library, and I'm in charge of library events. And on behalf of all of us, thank you for coming out here tonight. I know construction is kind of in front of the building, so we appreciate the adventures that you had in coming through the front door. So thank you very much. Today's an interesting day. Not only is this a nice event this evening, but it's also the beginning of our summer reading program, which we have every year. This year's read is going to be just wonderful. It has kind of do-it-yourself theme. It's called Make It Happen. And you can register at any of the desks. There's actually a game for teens, youth, and adults. And you can win fabulous prizes for just reading 5 books over the summer. We have events all throughout the summer. I mentioned it's a do-it-yourself theme. There are lectures, crafts, concerts. There's a concert with recycled instruments. We even have a stop-motion animation program teaching you how to do that. So lots of different things happening on the summer. Please sign up and also check out all of our events at aadl.org. So we hope that you do that. And I mentioned tonight's event is really a special event. I think it's very special. I grew up in New Hampshire, and I haven't been back in 30 years, and tonight's author is from Maine, so I always get excited when there's a fellow New Englander. I've gotten rid of my accent a bit, but I always get excited when a fellow New Englander comes and I get to talk to them. Not only is Linda from New England, but she is America's only female sword fishing captain, which I think is really cool. She's the author of 3 New York Times best-selling books. She won the U.S. Maritime Literature Award. She's the winner of the New England Book Award for nonfiction. She's also written mysteries, and she was a character in the famous book, The Perfect Storm, which became a wonderful, wonderful film. She's been on television, Good Morning America, Today. She's on the Discovery Channel. She's done so much, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Linda Greenlaw.
You know, it wasn't all that long ago when I was spending a lot of time praying that no one would show up at any of my book events. But I've come a long way. Thank you very much. And I mean it. You can't imagine two more dissimilar worlds than those of a commercial fisherman and a book touring author. This is definitely the world in which I am a lot less comfortable. I have notes, and I apologize. You wouldn't think I'd need notes to talk about myself, but I've done some of these events and just kind of decided to wing it with no notes. And when it's time for Q&A, the first question is usually, can you tell us something about your book? So it's probably a good thing if I glance at them once in a while. As long as I'm apologizing for notes, I'll offer one other apology. And that is in advance for any inadvertent slip into what I refer to as salty language. I had a pretty strange upbringing. I was raised in a household where I wasn't allowed to use the word hate or tell someone to shut up. Well, shit, damn, and hell were okay even from toddlers. So on we go, and I will try to keep it clean. I won't assume that anyone here knows much of my background, and that's probably the best place to start and lead up to where I am right now. I was raised on and off the coast of Maine, where boats and fishing are the way of life. I spent my early childhood trying to catch anything that swam or crawled around the shores surrounding my home. When I was at an age where kids were learning how to ride bikes, I was learning how to row. When 10-speed bikes were all the rage, I had my first 10-horse outboard. And so it seemed a very natural step at the age of 19, when I desperately needed money for school, to step onto a commercial fishing vessel and head offshore for 30 days, much to my parents' dismay at the time. The age of 19, absolutely fell in love with my life. Knew I was going to do it the rest of my life. I did finish school. I fished my way through school, literally. I fished every summer, every vacation. Anytime I had 2 or 3 days off, I was hitchhiking to Portland, Maine, and trying to get aboard a boat, even if it was just to work at the dock aboard the boat. So really loved it. Graduated and took my degree in English offshore, knowing that that was the only thing I was ever going to do. Worked my way up to the captain's chair in a very traditional way, and that was I stayed on the same boat long enough to become first mate, and the owner of the boat bought a second boat, and that was my first opportunity to be skipper. Skippered many boats over the course of many years, many different fisheries, but always returned to my first love, and that was sword fishing. The last 6 years of the first 20 that I spent sword fishing, I captained the Hannah boat, and that's the boat everyone's familiar with from The Perfect Storm. And I reached a really high degree of success with that boat. I had the best boat, the biggest boat, the fastest boat, the best gear. That enabled me to get the best crew, and all I had to do was know how to work, and it all worked really well, and really reached the top of my game. Got to the age of 38 and thought, you know what? There's nowhere for me to improve my life here. Maybe I should go home. All my girlfriends were married with children, and I thought, this is maybe I've been missing out on this. While I've been offshore, everyone's been settling down and having families, and it's something I always desired. So I quit sword fishing. I was pretty happy to go back to my little island off the coast of Maine. It was nice because I could still make my living on the water. I bought a small inshore lobster boat, a bunch of lobster traps. Everything worked really nicely. I never did get married or have kids. I have come to believe that I am not flawed, but my plan was flawed. I moved, you know, settled down on an island where there are three single men, two are gay, one's my cousin. So the flawed plan. Okay. Very early on in my flawed plan, the book was published, The Perfect Storm. And, you know, people always ask, how did The Perfect Storm change your life? And I know that they're asking about the weather event. The storm itself didn't change my life at all. It was back in 1991. I continued to fish. But the book about the storm, I hold responsible for how my life has changed over the course of the last 10 years. And not even the whole book, just this one passage. And I have memorized it, and I never miss the opportunity to quote Sebastian Junger when there's an audience listening, so pay attention. Sebastian Junger said, "The Hannah Bowden is skippered by a Colby College graduate named Linda Greenlaw. Not only is Greenlaw one of the only women in the business, she's one of the best captains, period, on the entire East Coast. Year after year, trip after trip, she makes more money than anyone. When the Hannah Bowden unloads her catch in Gloucester, swordfish prices plummet halfway around the world." I love that part. You can imagine it's been a pretty tough image for me to live up to. People who are really familiar with The Perfect Storm and meet me for the first time and know me as, you know, the woman who survived The Perfect Storm, after hello, the next thing I usually hear is, "We thought you'd be a lot bigger." And there's some degree of disappointment in, you know, people are genuinely disenchanted when they meet me for the first time, and I end up apologizing for not being bigger when people say that's really strange. Probably the most interesting change that very generous portrayal brought my way was this. I got in from lobster fishing one night, and I had a message on my answering machine. "Hi, Linda, this is Emily Bessler calling from Simon & Schuster. We've read The Perfect Storm, and we're really intrigued with this female fisherman thing you have going on. Do you want to write a book?" And at the time, I thought, that sounds like a lot of work. No, I don't want to write a book. I really like this female fisherman thing I have going on. I've been doing it a long time. No, I didn't want to write a book. I never even returned the woman's phone call. It's probably rude, but anyway. Within a week's time, okay, The Perfect Storm was on the top of every bestseller list everywhere. And within a week's time, I had two more identical calls from major publishers in New York saying, "We've read The Perfect Storm. We want you to write a book." And the third call was, "We've read The Perfect Storm. We'll pay you to take a year off from fishing to write your book." So I had to realize what an opportunity I was being handed. I have friends who would kill for the opportunity to have a book published. I have friends who write beautifully, yet they can't, you know, they get rejection letters knowing that whoever sent the letter probably hasn't even looked at their material. So how lucky was I that I'm being invited to write a book that's going to be published and paid to write it? And that was really cool. Well, it took me a year to write my first book, The Hungry Ocean, and it was the most difficult thing I had ever done in my life, bar none, the most difficult work. I'm used to working hard. I'm a fisherman. Does not compare at all to writing. Well, nobody was more surprised than I was when The Hungry Ocean became a bestseller, and with that success came offer number two, write another book. I wrote another book, and then another book. Okay, so fast forward, 6 books, 10 years, 10 lobster fishing seasons. That 10-year period when I had left sword fishing, I always believed I'd go back to it. I always thought, you know, next year I'm going to go sword fishing. Next year I'm going sword fishing. And I got calls with people saying, you know, hey, there's a boat in Newfoundland or there's a boat in Puerto Rico. All we need is a captain. But the timing was never right. I could never just drop what I had going on. I either had 800 lobster traps in the water, I can't just abandon them, or I had, in the middle of a 60-city book tour, as much as I'd love to call the publicist and say, I'm bailing out, I'm going offshore, it's just, you know, not my thing. I had to take it seriously. So I could never do it. And the more that time marched on, the more I knew it was becoming less and less likely that I'd ever return to it. So 2 years ago, got one of these calls, you know, there's a boat in New Bedford, Massachusetts, you know, come take it. I realized it probably would be the last chance I had to say yes. So I said yes, very irresponsibly, and dropped everything and went offshore. Now, when I said yes and, you know, I got to a point of it's too late to back out of this, I started getting really nervous because I realized that I was risking a lot. And people, you think of commercial fishing, it tops the list of dangerous jobs all the time. But that wasn't what I was concerned about. I've been fishing since I was 19 years old. What I felt I had at risk was my entire identity. The 10 years since I had left sword fishing, if anybody asked me what I did for a living, I said I was a sword fishing captain. Anytime I was introduced as a best-selling author, I was actually embarrassed. It's like, now that's weird. But I really, you know, my heart says I'm a fisherman. My checkbook might say I'm a writer. So I felt, what if I go back and don't like it, or I'm going to like have total identity crisis here. What if I am not what I have believed I am for the first 48 years of my life? When I was 19 years old, I was told all I needed was a strong back and a weak mind to go fishing. And that combination suited the job to a T for many years. But at 48, going back to it, my back's not as strong. I'd like to think my mind is stronger. And so the question that I wanted to answer for myself was, does that combination work as well? Or does what you gain in maturity compensate for what fades in youth? My answer to that is yes. All my life, the most complimentary adjective that I could try, you know, to have myself or to attribute to someone else has been seaworthy. And I guess maybe I was wondering, could I still navigate the problems and difficulties inherent in being at sea for 30 days? Could I still weather a storm? Could I put blood on the deck? Could I still lead a crew of men? Was I still seaworthy? Most importantly to me was, did it still matter? My answer is yes, it did matter. Maybe not as much as it did when I was 19, but still very important. But I realize now that there are other adjectives that I like also. I would like to do, I obviously have not even looked at my notes, so forget about the notes for now. I think I'd like to do a reading, and I, with an audience of this size, usually the Q&A can go on for a while, and I really do encourage questions because that's really fun for me at this point to answer people's questions. I would like to do a short reading first. I started this book tour in New York City, and the very first book event was Seaworthy. And I was at a store and I was finally sat down to sign some books. And it was really clear that this one guy was sort of hanging back, like he wanted to be last in line. So I figured he wants to talk or something, because that happens sometimes. And really, you know, handsome guy, well-dressed, you know, suit and tie kind of guy. And he introduced himself as an attorney, New York City attorney. And then he said he wants to go fishing with me this fall. And I thought, you know, this guy either needs to watch Discovery Channel or read this book. He doesn't really want to go fishing with me. So I thought it'd be fun to read, you know, I got this phone call. I'll set it up a little bit. I'm borrowing a book to read from because I don't have one. That's awful. I get this phone call 2 years ago from this guy, Jim Buddy. He's the manager of four boats, and he needs a captain. I've said yes, and now it's time for me to find crew. I have this Rolodex that I've held on to for 10 years with all my crew information in it because, you know, I knew I was going back eventually. My mind raced ahead of my Rolodex as I frantically searched the dog-eared cards for Ringo's number. Did I have it under Tom? Did I have it crammed in the seas for crew? I couldn't imagine going offshore without Tom Ring. I had had the good fortune of great crew members while captaining the Hannah Bowden and knew that Ringo would be my first round draft pick for the upcoming trip. Like me, he hadn't been sword fishing in the last decade, but also like me, he'd been working on the water and dreaming about a comeback and waiting for the right opportunity. And now, opportunity was knocking. Ringo answered the phone, but he wasn't about to answer the knock. He had been gillnetting with the same captain for some years now and wouldn't feel right about leaving him in the lurch, he said. I wondered when Ringo had become scrupulous. Besides, he explained, my life has changed. I'm a grandfather. That was a tough one to argue with. Ringo had played the grandfather card. There was no sense trying to sway him. Ringo was out. So Ringo's life had changed? No shit, whose hadn't? If your life doesn't change in the course of a decade, there must surely be some moss growing. I had settled down significantly in the past 10 years, and the changes had been good. Although I'd never married, I did have the best guy friend, Simon. Sure, I had pushed for a permanent relationship, including a ring, but Simon just couldn't get there. We did, however, go Dutch treat on a cement mixer, and that's about as committed as I'd ever been. I had long given up on the wedding bells. And furthermore, Ringo's grandchild, just for the record, is his wife's daughter's baby, not even blood related. His life had changed. What about mine? If Ringo could claim he was a grandfather, I could say I was a mother. In fact, talk about change in responsibility. I had become the legal guardian of a teenage girl just 1 year before. I'd gone from 0 to 15 with a stroke of a pen. Granted, I was still in the process of getting to know Soraya and hoping I'd do a better job than her former guardian. But Soraya would be well cared for in my absence, I justified. In fact, the more I thought about it, the more comfortable I was about shirking this particular responsibility. As I flipped through the cards, it soon became clear that most of the guys I'd like to have fishing with me could not pass muster in any background check. And this is a problem without looking at your notes, because I forgot to mention something. Right after I said, yes, I'll take this boat, I found out that Discovery Channel was going to be coming along with me and documenting the whole trip. So I was required to send in a list of crew members with Social Security numbers. And I sent my list in, and I get a call, nope, these guys aren't going. We can't put them on TV. So I sent in, So I sent in my B list. Nope, no one's going. So, okay, on we go. Search for crew. My second choice after Ringo would be Kenny Puttister, the red-headed newfie I'd worked with for years. Kenny would probably be fishing with Scotty aboard the Eagle Eye, too. It wouldn't be very ethical of me to try to steal him. Besides, if I were Kenny and had to choose between the two captains, me or Scotty, I'd go with Scotty, too. There was no point in putting myself through that humiliation. I had absolutely no way of getting in touch with choice number three, Carl. He owed me some money, so there was little chance he'd surface if I put feelers out. James was in Ireland. I hadn't heard from Ivan in years. I hesitated on a card on which I'd written, moron. The moron would be available, but I just couldn't do it. I'd signed on to spend 60 days, a minimum of 1,000 miles from home, bobbing around the North Atlantic Ocean during the height of hurricane season in pursuit of swordfish. I would be living and working in less than optimum conditions very closely with four men. In the past, I had not minded working with men who behaved like animals, or morons for that matter. They got the job done. I had always hired from the neck down. But at the age of 47, I realized that I had changed and that perhaps my criteria for crew needed to change. I took a break from the Rolodex to check email and was happy to find a note from Jim Buddy. Jim must have some innate sense about things. I marveled as I read his email. He had sent a list of potential crew members with short bios and contact information. He listed five guys, all of whom had experience fishing on the boats he managed, and all of whom he'd recently contacted regarding work. The names, except for one, were unfamiliar to me. The first bio read like a personal ad, with details about eye color and zodiac sign. No thanks, I'm all set, I thought. The second sounded like a backwoods Rambo type of guy. Nope, I've fished with the likes of them, not this time. The third one Jim referred to as the Silver Fox and noted that he'd been sober for 2 weeks. Great, an old drunk. I'm not that desperate. I have a friend who trumps the fox, out of rehab and straight for 3 months, but I'm not taking him offshore. Possibility number four was Mr. Weeks. Would I have to call him Mr.? Too weird for me. The additional comment that Mr. Weeks had actually captained the Seahawk for a short while and might need an occasional reminder that he was no longer in charge sealed his fate. One boat plus two captains equals nightmare. This was beginning to resemble audition week for American Idol. It's one thing to accept opportunity and quite another to capitalize on it. The right crew would be essential in maximizing this opportunity. So as it turned out, I ended up with this totally made-for-TV crew. When none of my usual guys could kind of pass muster, I started calling friends of mine that I knew were nice men and didn't have any criminal records. So I ended up with four really great guys who ended up being perfect for this particular trip, because I knew at the end of it all that if I'd had anyone with any real experience, they would have realized right off the bat that things were not right on this trip, and they would have, like, mutinied, and that would have been the end of the whole deal. So I was arrested, and I discuss it in Seaworthy. And any one of my four guys would have gone to jail for me if they could have. So anyway, just really great guys. Does anybody have questions? That might be good. I find water. Any questions?
Oh, as a person who makes a living on the ocean, would you comment on the BP oil spill, please?
Yes. You know, I don't think my opinion is any different than anyone else that you've, you know, seen or heard, or probably everybody in this room. I'm saddened. My heart goes out to the fishermen and their families in the Gulf of Mexico. I'm disgusted because it seems that BP had no plan in place for worst case scenario. I mean, who lives their life that way? You get on an airplane and, you know, the flight attendant is telling you, find the closest exit. You've got a bigger chance of being struck by lightning than you do in an airplane crash. So, I mean, it seems, you know, that they were just so negligent and so irresponsible. And, you know, they're saying, well, we're going to clean up every last drop of oil and we're going to make it right for everyone. But, boy, it's hard to believe, you know, the oil's still gushing. And I think over the course of the last 30 years, every fish that I have harvested has gone to feed an overweight and heart-diseased country. And look at the number of fish now being killed by oil that are just absolutely wasted. Yeah, so thanks for that.
Keeping the questions along with the serious tone from the first gentleman, whatever happened to Stern Fabio?
Okay, so you've read the Lobster Chronicles. Yeah, you know what? The last I knew, he was working in a restaurant in Portland, Maine, and pretty much, you know, had the same reputation he, you know, had when I stumbled upon him. Yeah, yeah, he's still around. Yeah.
I'll get the name of the restaurant.
Yeah, okay.
What's the status of swordfish out there off the coast now? And lobsters, I've heard about a red tide this summer, and what's going on out there?
Okay, first of all, red tide does not affect lobster. It does affect clams and mussels, and sadly, you know, I can collect those in front of my house, but last summer, all season, red tide, and they're talking about it already this year. So, you know, we have to get our fill of clams and mussels really early in the spring before the red tide. And we've had, you know, a pretty good amount of rain, so it's pretty likely we're going to have red tide again. I am very happy to be able to tell you that lobsters and swordfish, the stocks are very healthy. North Atlantic swordfish stock is at 100% maximum sustainable yield. The stock is totally rebuilt. Even the scientists and the government are now agreeing that that's true. The best evidence that I can offer you about that is the first 20 years that I went sword fishing. If we had the average, an average fish of about 100 pounds, so the fish averaged 100 pounds each, that was pretty good. Last year, I had a 171-pound average fish. I mean, the fish are big. And it wasn't just me. I mean, it's a very small fleet that goes from the United States to the Grand Banks. Fish are big for a lot of reasons. You know, there are some good regulations that have been in place for a long time. There are country-based quotas. The U.S. swordfish fleet goes the extra mile in that we are required to use circle hooks as opposed to a traditional J-hook. The beautiful thing about a circle hook is that 95% of the fish are hooked in the corner of the mouth. They're all alive, as opposed to years ago when I swordfished with a J-hook, a lot of fish ingest the hook. If you catch a juvenile fish with a circle hook, you pop the hook out and it swims off, and you say, yep, you know, grow up and come back. So it's been very good. It's been very good for the industry. Lobster fishing in Maine is a very strong fishery. Sadly, lobsters and swordfish, we don't get enough money for them. I like to tell people, you know, and they're worried about, you know, what they should eat and this and that, to make sure that you're asking if you like fish, make sure it's caught in the United States. You know, eat the local stuff or eat the stuff that's harvested by American fishermen. U.S. fishermen are the most highly regulated, managed, monitored, and patrolled bunch of fishermen on the planet. If it's something available to you and you know it was caught by U.S. fishermen, we have a more environmentally friendly fishery. There's all the good things, so eat it and feel good about it. Thank you.
Well, I hate to ask this, but what about mercury in big fish? Like, is there something special about your fish up there that we could eat?
No, there is something special about my fish, and I... Yeah, the mercury thing, you know, in my lifetime we've been through two mercury scares, and there are two different times in my fishing career that sword fishing's actually been shut down and people have been told, don't eat it. You know, there's a list, and I've seen these cards that, you know, one of the environmental groups puts out about, you know, it's a list of fish, and if it's red, don't eat it, if it's green, eat it, if it's yellow, eat it with caution. That list is bullshit. Okay, I ask audiences all over the country. I do extensive book touring and speaking to very large audiences everywhere. And I always ask when the mercury question comes up, because people, I mean, you don't want to eat something that's going to make you sick. Is there anyone in this room who is aware of anybody in their lifetime who has been sick or died from mercury poisoning from eating fish? One. That's the first one ever. Okay, I eat fish all the time, as I said, but I think these groups of people saying don't eat fish because of mercury, there are toxins in everything you eat, everything you drink, and in the air you breathe. For it to reach a level of poison, you have to eat so much, it has to reach a level. I think you'd have to eat your maybe weight in swordfish a day for I don't know how long for it to become a problem. I don't know anyone who eats more swordfish than I do. I haven't been to the doctors to see if I have high mercury levels, but I feel pretty good. And again, it goes back to, you know, we're in the middle of an obesity crisis. Number one killer of women in this country is heart disease. You need to eat fish. Swordfish is in the top 10 in the omega-3 fatty acid. It's very good for you. And, you know, I wouldn't, like, challenge someone and say, you know, see if you can die from mercury poisoning, see if you can eat enough. But you know, you are, ma'am back there, the only one I've ever seen raise her hand that you're aware of someone who ate too much fish and had a problem with mercury.
Hi.
Hi.
I wonder if you could describe your process of catching swordfish in more detail, how long the lines are, how many hooks, what you use as bait, how many usable fish do you have on a line when you pull it in?
Sure.
How did you get arrested?
Yeah, the method of sword fishing is called long lining. And a typical set is, which would be a 24-hour period, a typical set would be a laying out or a setting out of one line that would be at a length of 30 or 40 miles. And as that goes out the stern, baited hooks are attached. So let's say a 40-mile set, you'd have 1,000 baited hooks on it. That's cut free from the boat, and it drifts. Oh, and there are floats put on it also, so it's relatively close to the surface because we're fishing in like 3,000 fathoms of water. Swordfish are nocturnal. They come up, they chase the bait to the surface at night, so the line is relatively close to the surface. That is cut free from the boat. It drifts with current. Where the places we fish are where two bodies of water come together. For instance, east of the Grand Banks is where the hot water of the Gulf Stream pushes up into the cold water of the Labrador Current. Where these two pieces of water come together, there's a big tide change. And where there's a big current change, stuff collects. It's where the plankton is, and then, you know, the food chain, so the bait is there, and that's where we hope the swordfish are going to be. That's where we find the most productive, you know, sword fishing. The next morning at daylight, which is, we're so far to the east, it's like 3:30 in the morning, you know, we grab the end of the gear and start hauling it back on the boat. It's hauled back onto this big, it's like a gigantic spool of thread, okay? And the hooks are taken off at the rail as this line's going back onto the giant spool, hydraulically driven. Get weight on the line, it means you have a fish coming, you stop the boat, and it's one man, or in my case, a woman, hand over hand until, you know, you see what it is. So it's catching fish one at a time with hooks.
Well, how many fish could you get on a line?
Well, you know what? It's fishing. So it really, you know, we really need to average about 3,000 pounds a night to get a trip. We keep our trips, it's important to tell you this, we keep our trips in sync with the lunar cycle. So that's why the trip is about 28 to 30 days. Because these bodies of water and the tide, you know, is affected by the moon, the fishing is better from the first quarter through the third quarter. It's really good just 3 or 4 days either side of the full moon. So we do our steaming back and forth and our turnaround time, or the time at the dock when we're resupplying and unloading during the new moon or when you don't see a moon. So 3,000 pounds a night, you know, you might fish for anywhere from 10 nights if the fishing's good to, I suppose some guys would make up to 20 sets. I've never had to do that myself, but I would be prepared to if the fishing was really slow. A lot of things affect the fishing. If the weather's really severe, you don't catch as much. You pull more fish off because of the circle hooks, or, you know, it's really soft mouth. If for some reason Mother Nature is just not cooperating and these two pieces of water aren't really jamming together the way we really need them to, the fishing would be slow. So a lot of factors. Best day of fishing I've ever had was about 10,000 pounds. It was you know, back a while ago, so it was like 107 fish for about 10,000 pounds. I've never been skunked, which is like a goose egg at the end of the day, but other people have. And I've had as few as, you know, 5 or 6 fish on 1,000 hooks. So it really, it fluctuates, it varies a great deal.
You mentioned that you were 19 when you fell in love with your life and decided to do this. It's working. I'm 19, and it's really inspiring to hear your story. And I'm just wondering, what gave you the courage? I don't know if you even know what struck you to do something so different.
Well, you know, at the time it was really different for a young girl to go fishing. But I don't know, I loved fishing as a kid. Back in 1979, when I was 19, there was a lot of money in commercial fishing. I needed a lot of money for school, okay? And I didn't want to be on the 10-year plan at school. I wanted to get through in 4 years. I needed to make some money, and I was really fortunate that I was able to pay my way through college in that way. I never felt, you know, I get a lot of questions. In fact, was it this morning? I'm getting really confused. Either this morning or yesterday morning, I did a talk, and it was really scary, to 100 professional women. It was their breakfast meeting, and I was scared to death. Because they have all these questions about the woman, and, you know, they always say, what's it like to be the woman in the male-dominated field of commercial fishing? I would say, you know what? I've been outnumbered. I've not been dominated. But but I get that question a lot. And, you know, my answer to that is gender has never been an issue. I don't know if I am particularly thick-skinned or thick-skulled, but it just hasn't been an issue. I found something that I love to do. I worked really hard at it. And the obstacles that challenge fishermen are things like bad weather, poor fishing, crew problems, mechanical breakdowns. I mean, those things aren't any tougher on a woman than they are on a man. So that's my answer to that. Thanks.
I was wondering what brought you back to it the second time around here. And I'm curious about two things, you know, the obvious motivations of making a living, things like that. But is there something about, you know, being out in a boat, managing a group of men, whatever it happens to be, you know, what is it that you really love about it that made you want to come back after 10 years?
Yeah, it's such a tough thing to articulate, and the best way that I can answer that is to go back to the title of my very first book, The Hungry Ocean. The Hungry Ocean's from a Shakespearean sonnet, and I've learned, you know, in the course of my travels that it means different things to different places, in different places that I go. But to me, the Hungry Ocean refers to the ocean's ability to totally consume. I've been fishing for 30 years. I have been consumed by it. I mean, I know it sounds cliche to say you're drawn to or taken with something, but I like the way I feel when I'm at sea, and I am passionate about catching fish. So, I mean, as proud as I am to be like a best-selling author, I mean, nothing makes me prouder than saying I'm a fisherman. And don't ask me now, well, you like the way you feel at sea, how do you feel? Because then it gets even more difficult to answer that one. I don't know. It's just a good feeling, you know. And as corny as this sounds, you've seen The Perfect Storm. And you know George Clooney's soliloquy as he's steaming out about being a sword boat captain. It's corny, but, you know, it gets me right here.
Hi. You mentioned your fish is typically from 100 to up to 170 pounds. I just can't visualize how do you handle it. Do you have some kind of special machine or whatever? I can't even carry 30 pounds of thing.
Okay. Well, first of all, you're hauling the line hydraulically. So, but then, okay, I'm hauling the gear. I'm on deck. I'll get the visual here. I'm on deck. I'm the captain. I'm driving the boat with this hand. I'm running the drum or the big spool, the hydraulic valve here. And this hand, the main line, this 1,000-pound test line, is going through my hand. It's sliding through it, right? And I'm driving the boat along the gear. I've got the line going through my hand. And the line is like this next to the boat, off the bow, okay? Now suddenly the line is like this. Something's coming, right? And someone's going to yell, fish on. And I'm backing the boat down, trying to stop the forward motion because I don't want to rip the hook out of the fish's mouth. Okay, so you get the boat pretty much dead in the water. And then it's one man or one woman, just hand over hand. And you think about it. I'm on a 100-foot steel vessel. My feet are planted. I've got 100 feet of steel under me. The fish is just in the water. You know, there's not a fish I can't get to the surface. Some are a little tougher than others, but I also have four 350-pound men right here. So when I get tired of doing this, you know, one of them's pushing me out of the way and you know, grabbing it. Basically, when the fish breaks the surface, if it's a good-sized fish, it takes everyone on the boat to get it aboard. And if it's really too big, you know, there's something called a door cut in the side of the hull. It's just a cutout to make, instead of pulling a fish all the way up and over the rail and onto the deck, you just slide it on. So with, you know, four or five people pulling, you can get a pretty big fish aboard. And if it's just too big to do that, then we have a strap that we can put around the fish's tail and lift it hydraulically onto the boat. Yeah. That's probably a much longer answer than you needed, but.
Okay. Another question.
I've never eaten swordfish. I'm allergic to fish. But have a question. What's the so-called sword on the swordfish? What function does that appendage have?
Well, you've probably seen a picture. It is a sword, or we call it a bill or a sword. And it's flat this way, and it's very sharp on the edges. Okay? So it's like this on the fish. And they use it for two different things. Primarily, they use it to feed themselves. So a swordfish will swim through a school of bait and slash the sword back and forth and then circle back and eat the fish that it's injured with its bill. And they're bottom feeders also. I mean, during the day, they're on the bottom, and they scuff around the bottom and, you know, injure the fish. They also use it as a weapon, you know, if they're being attacked by a shark or another fish. We've caught some fish with some pretty nasty-looking scars on them, so we do think they're warriors. Yep, definitely.
When you looked at this boat for this trip, I felt my heart sink. It's like, wow, is this boat going to be all right? How did you know?
Well, we're talking about the Seahawk and the boat that I fished in Seaworthy. My guys had been in New Bedford working on the boat for a week before I showed up. And I flew into Boston, they picked me up, and all the way back to the boat, they're, yeah, nah, 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 oh, it's so bad, whoa, wait till you see it, nah, 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 nah. And they were right. I mean, it was late at night, and I wanted to just go to the hotel and go to bed. They're like, oh, no, we don't want you to sleep tonight either. So, you know, I went and looked, and yeah, it was the boat hadn't been fishing in a couple of years. The last captain had died aboard the boat. The boat, the owner had put it up for sale, been out of the water. Now it's one of four in a fleet. So the other three captains and crews are saying, well, that boat's not going fishing again. Let's go take everything that's useful. So it's basically been scavenged. You know, we didn't have any tools. We didn't have any this, no spare parts. So we did the best job we could in a short time to get the boat together. While the boat was in a sad state of disrepair and all the systems, because boats are like everything else. If you don't use them, things start falling apart. The boat was not unsafe. I mean, I wasn't afraid we were going to sink, although we almost did. Yes.
I wanted to ask you about the Perfect Storm. Is that movie accurate about the fishing? I remember the winch and actually carrying one of the guys overboard. I don't know how likely that is, but I suppose that's possible. But as far as the catching of the fish.
Yeah, they portrayed the way of life very nicely, Warner Brothers, and pretty good with the fishing. And the fish themselves, they didn't kill a fish to make that movie. Those fish were all rubber and motorized and things. And really, the fish looked real to me. And I've seen a lot of swordfish. I think they did a good job. To me, the best part of the movie was the fact that it brought a way of life that I'd been enjoying for so many years to the public's eye. And people want to know where their fish come from. They want to know where your food comes from. So The Perfect Storm was the first of sort of all this interest in commercial fishing, so that was great. And no, people aren't generally hooked and pulled overboard. And if they are, somebody else doesn't jump in after them off of a boat that's steaming away from them. So you know what? It seemed like they took every possible bad thing that could happen and put it all in that movie, which made it, you know, a great movie. But the fact of the matter is, nothing was ever found of the Andrea Gale. I mean, nothing. They never got a mayday call off. There was none of that screaming back and forth between, Billy Tyne and I. There was no romantic interest between the other captain and myself, although because George Clooney was the lead, I was okay with that. But it just, it wasn't truthful in that regard. It was Hollywood, but I liked it.
So what did you think of the person playing your
Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio?
Yes.
I mean, because it was George Clooney, I would have preferred to play myself. I was actually quite pleased with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, because before they did the casting, I thought, okay, female fisherman, this could be ugly. And she's lovely, so I was actually very happy with the choice. Yeah.
If you could press rewind for your life, what would you have done differently?
If I could press rewind, I know where I'd stop, but I don't know what I would change. You know, people always say you don't regret the things you do, you regret the things you haven't done. And honestly, there's not a lot that I haven't said yes to when people ask me to do it. So I don't have a lot of regrets. I suppose, even like my arrest, I mean, that's probably the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I can't really think of a way that I could have avoided it. I mean, you can read the book and read the details, but I'll have to think about that. Maybe I'll think of something before we're done, but right now I don't know what I'd change. I'll think of some smart-ass answer in a minute. Give me a minute.
I was going to ask you about why you were arrested.
Okay, I was arrested for illegal entry and illegal fishing in Canadian waters. Canada has a 200-mile limit, as does the United States, as does any country with any coastline that does any fishing. It's an imaginary line, 200 miles off the coast of Canada. Well, I made my 30-mile set, and I was very legal. I was south of that line, so I was in international water. And we're hauling the gear back the next day. As I said, I work on deck all day, hauling the gear back. We don't have electronics on deck because it's a saltwater environment and it just wouldn't last down there. So we're in the process of hauling this gear back. It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and we got buzzed by a Canadian fisheries patrol plane, which is not unusual. They patrol that line as they should. They're very protective of their territory. So we're all waving at the plane, which we normally would. And then we got buzzed again. And the third time we got buzzed, I said, I better go up in the wheelhouse because I didn't have a radio on deck or anything. I said, maybe someone's in trouble and I need to, maybe they need my assistance. Well, I got up in the wheelhouse and I took one step in and I could see the chart plotter, which is the thing that shows me where I am. And I could have thrown up. I was 4 miles on the wrong side of the line. Well, I couldn't, so long story short, I was arrested. The boat was seized. I was taken into Newfoundland, handcuffed, jailed. I wasn't in jail long because the money was in place for me to be bailed out, and I needed to go to court several months later to stand trial. So I went back out, I was released, and I went back out fishing, and I still couldn't imagine what had happened. I've been doing this since I was 19 years old. I mean, I know which way the Gulf Stream goes. I know which way the Labrador Current pushes. Your gear doesn't go north. Anyway, I got back out fishing in a couple of days, and a friend of mine was steaming out to, you know, come join the crowd and fish too. And, oh, when I was arrested, I had to leave a mile of gear behind. We didn't finish hauling the gear. I said, this is the least of my problems. Forget it. So this boat steaming out calls on the radio and says, hey, Linda, I found your piece of gear you left behind here, and I'll pick it up and I'll deliver it when I get there. I said, great, thanks. So a little while later, he called me on the radio. He had my gear aboard his boat, and he said, it's been run over by a ship. It's like all covered with bottom paint, or anti-fouling paint, and it's instead of a mile stretched out, it was all like in a big ball. So that was my aha, oh, moment of that's how my gear, you know, it was towed by a ship to the north. But it didn't really matter when I went to court. Even I knew that, and it was clear that it wasn't intentional. The officers that came aboard the Seahawk to do the investigation could see that I made a very legal set, but they also could see I was 4 miles on the wrong side of the line. So intention had nothing to do with it. The only defense I had was due diligence, and it's a very high standard. No one has ever been acquitted of those charges, and I was not the first. So it was a very inadvertent, innocent, I like to think, stupid, very expensive mistake.
Something else, okay, over here. Oh, okay. Right here, did you have one? Okay.
I have a question about captain's responsibilities. In the movie, Perfect Storm, it seems to me that the captain let the crew decide whether they wanted to give up their catch and seek safety on an island instead of him taking the responsibility and say, we are going to leave the storm, and so he gave the responsibility for that decision to his crew, and that's what their fate was all about, and that saddens me. What's your comment?
My comment to that is, we talked about the movie, and I said what I liked about the movie. I didn't say what I didn't like about the movie, and the one thing that I disliked about the movie was Warner Brothers' portrayal of Billy Tyne and his crew making a conscious decision to steam into a storm that they thought might kill them. That's just not the way it happened. It was a very freak weather situation. Three low-pressure systems all came together. One, you know, weather in this hemisphere goes from west to east. In this case, one of these low-pressure systems backed up, went to the west. It was, you know, one hellish storm, and they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. We'll never really know what happened because nothing was found, but I guarantee you Captain Billy Tyne didn't ask the crew what they wanted to do. And, you know, are we Gloucester men? So we're going to steam into a storm because we want money, you know. So that was pretty much the Warner Brothers, yeah.
So, Linda, does that mean since your arrest that Discovery would run your Social Security number now and not feature you again?
Are you kidding? Since my arrest, I'm like number one on the hit parade on Discovery Channel. They didn't, you know, season one aired last summer, and that was a season in which I was arrested. And they didn't air my arrest. They didn't put any part of it in the show. And that was because nothing had been resolved when they were doing the editing, and they didn't want to leave like this major loose end. So whatever happened to Linda, last we saw her, she was going to jail, or cut me out of the show altogether or something. No, these have to be a little bit more criminal to not make the cut. Yes, oh, sorry.
What is the in your mind and as far as your feelings about it, what's the difference for you between going sword fishing and lobster fishing?
Oh boy, what a difference! Sword fishing is by far the most exciting, the biggest adventure. You know, that you're going so far from shore. You know, we're 1,000 miles from the closest dock. Swordfish are elusive. There's a bigger challenge to catch them, basically because of this water temperature thing, and it's so in flux. I mean, it changes by the hour. You're trying to keep track of, okay, 65-degree water was moving at 3.2 knots, but then, you know, I steamed up into the 60-degree water. That was only moving at 2 knots, and always trying to keep track of all these speeds and temperatures. Lobster fishing, you get up in the morning, you look out the window, and if it's blowing, you pull the covers back over your head and you go back to bed. I mean, I don't have to haul my traps. If I have 40 miles of gear in the water, it could be blowing 60. I have to haul it. I cannot just leave it. I'll lose it. And, you know, that's the end of the trip. It's the end of the season. So it's more exciting. It's a lot more fun to catch a 171-pound live swordfish than it is to catch a pound and a quarter lobster. Lobstering, any fixed gear fishing where you're fishing just a depth, okay, 60 fathoms of water is right there. It's been there for 100 years, and it's going to be there for another 100 years. So it's just not as much to it. It's not as big a challenge.
Three short questions. Have you ever gone overboard?
Okay,
have
wait,
you
one
ever...
at a time. No.
Okay. Okay. Have you ever lost a crewman?
No. I had one die, but not overboard.
Okay. And have you ever had any women on your crew?
No. And the reason for that, I'm asked that question a lot about the women. The first 20 years that I swordfished, I never had a single woman ask me for a job. Or it's called looking for a site. No one asked me for a site. And I think the reason for that, especially early on, was that commercial fishing just really wasn't in the realm of possibilities. It's not something young girls aspired to because they just probably weren't aware that it could be an opportunity. And I know that's changed now. I know young women are getting into everything. And there are a lot of women in lobster fishing. You know, some own their own boats, you know, some work in the stern with their husband, boyfriend, neighbor. So a lot of women in that industry. Sword fishing and other offshore fisheries are not careers that people are getting into. There's just not a lot of opportunity. There are fewer boats, there are more regulations. I'm hoping that's going to change because there is so much good news in the fishing industries now, the ones that have been regulated and have bounced back. I'd like to think there'll be opportunity for more boats and more people because it is good employment for some people. I told Discovery Channel that if they do 5 seasons, the 5th season is going to be my last one, and I'm going to have all female crew. That's going to be my swan song. Yeah, because that would be really good TV.
Well, you may have just answered my question. My question was, are you going to go out there and do this again?
I am. I'm going August 1st, and I have the Hannah Bowden back, so I'm really psyched about that. Yeah, the owners of the Hannah Bowden are rigging the boat for me now. That's quite a conversion because the boat's been crabbing for the last 10 years, so they're doing, you know, a lot of cutting torches right now and ripping the boat apart and getting ready, so it should be good. Thanks.
So what's your best fish story to tell us?
Well, that would be
to have one.
That would have to be the one that got away, right? Everyone has one that got away. You know, the one that got away is always like, it doesn't matter if you're a recreational fisherman, a freshwater fisherman, a fly fisherman, an ice fisherman, or a commercial sword fisherman. The one that you really remember that got away was so much bigger than anything you've ever seen. And it was the most hardest, longest fight you ever put up. And yeah, I've got one of those, but you just pretty much just heard it. Yeah, I've got one that got away. It was a swordfish, yeah.
As an English major and a writer, I'm sure you have, you read a lot, probably, yeah? May I ask what your favorite book is, or one of the top three favorite authors, couple?
Yeah, oh yeah, I can tell you my favorite author, by far, is Pat Conroy. And I was asked that question on my last book tour, and I didn't just say Pat Conroy. I went into such detail. I actually have this like huge crush on Pat Conroy. It's like I like have this secret fantasy life. I am in love with Pat Conroy. So I went on and on and on. I said way too much about Pat Conroy. And then I sat down to sign books, and then some woman, you know, I'm personalizing books, and she said, can you write it to Pat Conroy and Sally so-and-so? And I said, oh, you like him too? And she said, he's my husband. I was like, oh, my God. They happened to be vacationing in the town. I was doing my book signing, and she said, he's going to be so upset he wasn't here to learn about your huge crush on him. I was like, oh, my God. So I'm pretty sure she's not here tonight. I love Pat Conroy. Yeah, that was embarrassing. Yeah.
I was just curious about also bycatch, you know, the fish that you don't intend to catch. Do you keep other fish as well, sharks or whatever?
Yeah, we do. And sword swordfish longline is a fairly clean fishery because we are fishing with hooks. It's pretty selective. It's not like towing a net where you get everything in its path. So our gear is somewhat selective, but we do have bycatch. Other than swordfish, the things that we like to see are giant bluefin tuna, especially late in the fall because they have the right fat content. They're really worth a lot of money. Big eye tuna, yellowfin tuna. We catch a very occasional albacore tuna if we're fishing really hot water. Mahi-mahi, again, if we're fishing really hot water. Mako sharks, we catch a fair number of mako sharks. We like to see those because there's a market for mako. What we don't like to see are blue sharks. And that's about the only thing we catch that we can't keep. There's no market for them.
I was wondering if you had any experience with sailing vessels or quite a few schooners in New England, for example.
Well, my first experience on a sailboat was back when I was promoting my very first book, and as part of my book tour, I was doing a talk with Sebastian Junger, the author of The Perfect Storm, at a New York City yacht club. And we were invited to go for a sail before, you know, the evening event, and somebody took us out on a sailboat, and I'd never been on one, honestly. And there was not a breath of wind, and all the sails were up, and they're going blimp, 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 blimp. And I was thinking, wow, I don't like this so much. This is really not fun. And so that was my first experience. And then not long after that, I was dating a guy who was, like, really into sailing, and I went a few times on his boat, and I really enjoyed it when there was a lot of wind. About the time that he wants to shorten sail, I'm like, no, come on, this is great, I'm loving it. So I think, you know, when I get on a boat, I have a hard time, like, relaxing and really enjoying sailing because I always think of being on a boat as work. So I might need to change that mindset a little bit.
Linda, as an author, could you comment on, for a person that buys your book, does it matter if they buy a book to you? Does it matter if they buy a book or they buy it electronically, like for a Kindle or an iPad? Is there a commercial difference from your standpoint?
From my standpoint, I'd love it if you bought hardcover books, all of them, tonight.
And they're right there at the
SUE. Yeah, matter of fact, they're right here. I'm a huge supporter of bookstores. Bookstores have been very good to me. I get money for a download. I get paid if somebody downloads one of my books, but
it doesn't do anything for the bookstore.
It doesn't do a thing for the bookstore, okay. And we have too many bookstores going under. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Yeah, buy books. Okay. Yeah, thanks.
This is an exciting as a fishing story, but could you talk about becoming a writer? How did you learn to become a writer, and a little bit about the process?
Yeah, okay, well, as I said before, I majored in English in college, but I wasn't a writer. I majored in English in college because I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I knew I loved to read. And I figured if I could read and write essays, I could get through school, as opposed to math and science where you have to have a real answer. That's not going to be my thing. So I did, you know, when I agreed to write my first book, I was offered a co-writer, I was offered a ghostwriter. I was like, no, I can do this myself. And people always say, you know, where'd that confidence come from if, you know, you weren't really a writer? Well, confidence came from a couple of different things. I've always been a letter writer, always. I still am today. I don't like emails so much. I like to sit down and I like to write letters. And people like my letters. You know, I'll see someone say, oh, you know, I still have that letter you wrote me. I just read it again the other day. That doesn't make me a writer. That doesn't mean I can write a book. When I was a junior at Colby College, you know the blue book exam that you write your exams in? I had one of those handed back to me one time. The professor had written on the outside with red ink, Ms. Greenlaw, you are very unfamiliar with the material in this course. Well written, B+. Okay? So I said, yeah, I can write. Don't worry about it. I don't need a ghostwriter. And, you know, having said that, I mean, I already mentioned that writing is very difficult for me. It is work, and I treat it like a job. I treat it the same way I do my fishing, with the exception, I mean, the big difference between writing and fishing, they're both really hard work. I love the process of fishing. The end result doesn't matter so much. writing, I love my books. I do not like the process. I don't like sitting down every day after I sign a contract and forcing myself to sit there for 4 or 5 hours and write. It's a grind. And, you know, I always, you know, see, you know, I read interviews, other authors, you know, who, you know, geez, they write a book in 2 days or something, or, oh, the characters took over in the book write itself. Like, that is such bullshit. That does not happen. It is, and let, yeah, Pat Conroy, maybe.
I enjoy writing too, and I was just wondering how you feel about grammar and how language is changing these days through other mediums, and how I am very particular about grammar, but sometimes I feel like it kind of holds me back of what I want to say because it's not how you speak.
Okay, well, first of all, you misunderstood me because you said I enjoy writing too. I do not enjoy writing. I'm glad that you do, and my mom was raised like in this big extended farm, a dairy farm in Maine, and there were sort of these old maid aunts that lived in the family farm, and they were all English teachers. So my mother, you know, there's no Maine accent, and there's proper grammar, and that's pretty much the way I was raised, with the exception of the bad words, which were okay. I don't like getting email that's all botched up. And it's not, and people are, I think, are a little strange too when they send me an email. I think maybe they're concentrating too hard on trying to, like, I don't really care if your grammar is not right, but I don't like the LOLs. I would rather see you laugh out loud than have you write LOL to me on a text message, you know? Or I'd rather hear you laugh on the phone. So I don't really like the little shortenings of things. But I'm much older than you, obviously. Yeah.
Okay, I think we'll take one more question, and then we do want to leave time for the signing. So we'll have this gentleman here.
Well, I was going to ask, but you might have answered the question. I was going to ask, what happened to your accent?
That was it. Yeah, and I'm also one of these, and I'll keep this brief because we do need to sign books. Wherever I am, I inadvertently start talking like the people, and to the point where they think I'm making fun of them. Okay, now, I was in, I read my books for the audio. I've read 4 of them. And the first time I went to Grand Haven, Michigan, to sit in the studio for 5 days to read The Hungry Ocean, the second day in, you know, the people on the other side of the plexiglass are 2 women, an engineer and a producer. They're like laughing, and I'm like, what's so funny? They said, you sound like you're from Fargo. I said, I do? I don't know. I was all screwed up with, you know, their accents or something. Anyway, thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it. Thanks.